Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Jonathan Bales. And Jonathan is quite the interesting character. He created and founded two different companies, Roto Academy and Fantasy Labs, and more recently, Lucky Trader HQ. Fantasy Labs was invested in by Mark Cuban, which is pretty cool. And he is an excellent, excellent writer. I first got introduced to Jonathan's stuff, I don't know, probably 3, 4, 5 years ago. He'd written all these books about betting and daily fantasy, and I was interested in that at the time. And I've since seen him evolve into the spaces of NFTs and cryptocurrency. And in this conversation, we spoke about that. And we also spoke about his grandpa and what that was like. We spoke about what Mark Cuban investing in his company, how that story came to be. Overall, this was awesome. It was great to talk to Jonathan, and I think you guys will enjoy this one. As always, if you have any thoughts or feedback about the episodes, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to your feedback. But until then, this is my episode with Jonathan Bales.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Jonathan, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thanks so much, Danny. I'm honored to be here.
Awesome. Well, I figured we'd start off talking about your first bet ever. You're known as a gambler, fantasy sports player, and extraordinaire from that respect. But I'm curious, where did the betting begin for you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was always sort of betting as a kid. I was always playing games. It wasn't like betting for money or something. I was just always, into games and sort of challenging people and trying to win at games. I think it probably came from there. I remember when I was young, I would try to bet my dad that I couldn't do stuff. And one time I bet him that I couldn't make a half court shot in basketball, but if I made it, he would have to get me a Mickey Mantle card. And I made that, and then he didn't get me the card, and it was very, very upsetting. And then like years later, he got me the card. So delayed payoff. It was very rewarding. But my first sports bet I remember was I didn't bet on sports like when I was in high school too much until the end. The NFL had changed the rules around the coin toss, where if you won, you could defer. But sports books were leaving up odds on who would receive the opening kickoff as if it were random. But like certain teams, like, you know, the Patriots and whatever, would always defer, and certain teams always receive. So it was like pretty much free money. And so I did that for a little while until they caught on.
That's so interesting, because you were doing it because it has an edge, right? Like you saw an edge in the market, and it wasn't just like, let me just throw money at this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I thought I would make money.
Yeah. No, I think that most people would get into gambling or something like that, just being like, okay, let me just have some fun here. But you took an analytical approach, which is no surprise knowing you and knowing your stuff, but it's interesting to me.
Yeah. I think that some people, I guess, have fun, like the act of gambling, like going to a casino or something is fun. Like I consider myself sort of a degenerate gambler, but I almost never go. Once in a while, I'll go to a casino or something and play, like, I guess for fun, like if friends want to do it or something, but I don't really consider that fun. I think fun is like, trying to figure out some, peer-to-peer game and invoking game theory and trying to beat people to find an edge. That's a fun version of gambling for me versus, you know, playing roulette or something like that.
Yeah. So you never just like, it's a rare occasion that you just go to a casino.
Yeah, once in a while, you know, you'll do it, but not too much.
Gotcha. So I want to get into the childhood stories and some things like that. Talking about buying glass from your grandfather's advice, it sounds from reading your stuff that your grandfather was a very eccentric man in the sense of conspiracy theories and all that. But how did you come upon to start buying glass? And what was that story like?
I don't know if that this would be an area where I didn't have an edge, you know, unless the glass broke. He got really big into eBay and like selling things on eBay. This is also a story I put out on my blog about, I used to buy and sell Furbies. I got really deep in the Furby game. There was a lot of money to be made in Furbies in like the late 90s, I think. Yeah, I learned a lot from him in terms of selling on eBay. But yeah, we would like find the local yard sales to go to and stuff, and go there and like try to get all their best stuff. Like we'd be knocking on people's doors, me and my grandpa at like 5 a.m. Seeing what they had. And yeah, I don't know why he was so into glass. He also like thought the moon landing was fake and all these different things. So I don't really, he's like super optimal person to be trusting about, you know, what to invest in, but he really liked glass. He also liked Bitcoin years ago and way before I bought it, and I thought it was dumb. So maybe he's onto something with the glass.
What was your relationship like with your grandfather, or what is your relationship like?
Oh, it was great. Yeah. He passed away, a couple years ago, but yeah, I mean, it was amazing. It was my dad's, dad, and, he was super, super sharp. Despite the conspiracy theory stuff, he was very, very smart, he's really, really good at math, like almost like a genius. Yeah, he's just like a wild, crazy genius type of guy.
And do you think that a lot of your analytical mind comes from him or your father in some respect? Where does that come from?
Yeah, my dad. Yeah, he has the same thing, and then me. My mom is not. She's kind of like that. But yeah, that's from my dad and grandpa for sure.
Yeah, that's so interesting, man. So I want to continue on the story arc. When was that? Give me the time frame for buying glass.
Yeah, I was buying glass. I guess I was in high school. I was probably like 15, 16. We were looking in like the local papers for who was having yard sales and going to buy their glass.
But like, why glass of all things?
I don't know. I still don't know to this day. We were just buying glass.
That's amazing. Okay. So continuing the story, you go to college, and like me, very interestingly, you just got so enamored with fitness and trying to get as jacked as humanly possible. And how did that come to be?
I mean, I think that's a natural thing for guys. Like when I don't know, you just have a lot of time on your hands. You work out a lot. It's really, for me, there was no real reason, the health reason that I was doing it. It was literally only to look good, to get girls. That was it. I didn't care if it was like super unhealthy, nothing. I just wanted to look good. So I started to, I didn't really lift too much in high school, a little bit. I played football and stuff, so you know, you had to lift, but not too much. But then I really started to lift when I was like, I guess 18, 19, and tried to become, you know, pretty jacked. And I remember one story. I was when I first went to college, I started to take creatine, and I misread the already was purposely trying to take too much. And then I misread the label, and I ended up taking 16 times too much creatine as I was supposed to. And I went to my first test. It was a Spanish test. So this was like, I don't know, 2 weeks into my college career. And, you know, I was completely silent. And 2 minutes into the test, like parts of my body that shouldn't be like making farting noises were just like, you know, like really long, like really like, but like coming from my shoulder, really, really weird. Everyone's looking at me. I'm like completely red, so embarrassed. And I just like filled out the test as soon as possible and got out of there. It was so embarrassing. I failed my first college test, needless to say.
So like, but you still were mapping out as much creatine as possible. Like, did you have a spreadsheet? Like how much did you take this seriously?
At that time, a spreadsheet would have helped. I didn't have that at that time, but yeah, that was around the time that I started to like sort of track a lot of stuff. I was charting NFL games in Excel. At that time, it was like before people were doing that, like average depth of passes and motions, audibles, personnel formations, stuff like that. And then various other aspects of my life, but not with like great rigor or anything, just sort of putting it in Excel.
What types of metrics personally did you track for yourself?
At that time, not too much. Probably a couple years later, I started to really track fitness stuff. Not like in the way of counting calories and stuff like that, which I don't think is really that valuable. But I would just sort of make note of when I would like, you know, take a new supplement, or the way that I would lift if I did like sets of six for a month versus doing like sets of 20, things like that, to see what my body responded to. That I started to really chart that stuff, and I think that was pretty useful.
What do you find?
I found that I think in terms of working out, people probably place too much emphasis on, I don't think you need to do like really, really heavy, certainly to like build muscle mass and, you know, try to have like an aesthetically pleasing body, or, you know, as a guy, try to build muscle. You don't need to be doing like heavy deadlifts, like benching like sets of six and stuff. You know, sets of 20, even like sets of 30. I know that's not like sort of something that's considered conventional wisdom, but higher sets, I think, that were like really good form with pretty heavy weight. The way that I would do it I would count reps, but I would go to failure every single rep, and I would do 50 reps, but with weight that was too heavy, a weight that I could get to like 20 or 25 on the first one. And I would do 50 as quickly as I could. And I thought that was the best way for me to gain muscle. And then I would do 10 exercises that got me to 50 reps. So it's 10 different exercises, 500 total reps, but like heavy enough weight that you can't just do 50 reps with the weight.
And one body part per day, or all in one? How did that?
With that, you would do like max two. It depends on the body part, but usually three. Sometimes, you know, you would sort of mix in like full body stuff, like clean and jerks and stuff like that.
So was it like a push-pull legs, or it was just whatever you felt like in the moment?
Whatever I felt like. I would always... you know, I always have a plan, but pretty often would just adjust based on how my body felt. Or like, you know, sometimes you do pull-ups and you're supposed to do back, but you can tell that you're not going to have like a good workout for your back for whatever reason. Like, you're just weak. Well, you shouldn't do that then. Then you should do, you know, if that's not going to be a good productive workout, then maybe you should do burpees and do some like cardiocentric type of thing. So it would just depend.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I want to continue then to you graduating college and you writing your final paper on why we're in a simulation. And this was before a lot of well-known people came out and said that. I mean, this was, I don't know, around 2008, 2007. That's correct. And that's way before Elon Musk saying it more recently. And what made you think that we're in a simulation back then? And do you still believe that to this day?
I don't have like super great confidence that we're in a simulation, but I think that it's likely because, you know, if you could envision some scenario where humans become so advanced that we could create another universe, just like manipulate the laws of physics to create our own universe, which we're not even close to, but it is theoretically possible. You know, we're basically creating like a sort of computer program of how a universe should exist. We would like test a bunch of universes. We wouldn't just make one universe. We would make many, 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 many universes, like probably like a near infinite amount of universes. We'd just be running universes all the time. And so the chances that a civilization can become that advanced where they're effectively God are really, really low. Really low. But in my opinion, that's overridden by the number of universes that they could potentially create, which would be near infinite. And so it's kind of like similar to anti-fragility to me, or like the concept of like asymmetrical bets, where the probability of something could be low, but the payoffs are so high that it overrides it. In the same way, you know, if one alien civilization could get to the point where they could create universes, they'd create so many that the chances that we would be in one would be astronomically high. So that was my general theory. It's changed a little bit since then, but yeah, that was the idea of it.
Okay, two questions. How has it changed, first of all? And could you define antifragility for people who may not be familiar with the term?
Yeah, so the latter, anti-fragility is a term from Taleb, who's one of my favorite writers and living philosophers. You know, basically it's that for so long, if you drop a glass, you know, you're drinking something and drop a glass, it breaks. The glass is fragile. For so long, people thought of the opposite of fragile as something that's robust, like you drop a rock or a diamond or something, it doesn't break. But that's the robust thing is kind of a neutral state. The actual opposite would be something that benefits from chaos. So you drop it and it gets better. So a virus would be an example of this, you know, where if the more chaos, the better. There's a variety of different systems. Human evolution is a really good one, where, you know, we're here really because of different random mutations that we ultimately benefit from. So the more randomness, the better with human evolution. And so, yeah, the idea of anti-fragility was really, really impactful for me to really understand that. It was probably the most important concept that helped me in business and life. Basically, that making predictions about the future is really, really, is really difficult. You can work really hard to get better than other people, but it's still really, really, it's really challenging. Like if you look at sports betting as an example, you know, you might have, if you just flip a coin, you're 50% to win, and a really great sports bettor might win 55% of the time or 56. It's still near a coin flip. It's just really difficult to predict the future. But it's not as difficult to predict the payoffs, which is, you know, sort of zero sum games. It's, you know, what are other people going to do? And if what other people do impacts what you do, then you should mostly just focus on predicting public psychology and, you know, the payoffs if you're right. In finance, there's a saying, what do you win if you win? So most people focus on that first win, like how do you win? What are the probabilities, etc. But you, in my opinion, should focus more so on, okay, if I get lucky or if I happen to win, then what happens? What are the payoffs to me? And I think that is probably like the biggest payoff, and certainly in business, but other areas of life as well.
And now going back to the original question, which was about how your thinking on the simulation has changed over the past 13 years.
Yeah, so I guess the idea that the original hypothesis was that the civilizations that were that advanced would create a near infinite number of universes, that it would become exceedingly likely that we would be in one, even if the chances of them getting to that point were really low. I still think the chances that one would get to that point are really low, but I actually think that those are higher than before. And I think that the chances that they would create an infinite number are near an infinite number are lower. If they're that advanced, they probably, they wouldn't need to probably test as much as we think they would, type of thing.
Do you believe in aliens?
Oh yeah.
Do you think they've visited us?
That one I'm not sure on. I guess I'm agnostic. My guess is probably not, but I don't have a really strong opinion. I won't be super shocked if they did, but I would guess probably not as of now, just because the universe is relatively young. And if you think about, like, the closest star system, Alpha Centauri, is 4.1 light years away. Light goes around Earth 7 times in 1 second, 300,000 kilometers per second. It takes 7 minutes for light to go from the sun to Earth. And it takes 4.1 years to get to the closest star system. I think space shuttles need to go 26,000 miles per hour or something to leave Earth's gravity. We're not even remotely close. It would take so many years to even get to the closest star, which we know doesn't have, we're very unlikely to have life, certainly not an advanced form of life. So we're not even remotely close. It's really difficult to, the universe is really big and it's really difficult to travel around it.
What if we could bend time? Not if we, but what if a civilization could, in a way that we're not thinking about it?
Yeah, that would help. yeah, you could use wormholes. There's probably situations where that we don't really understand where space-time gets bent in such a way, whether it's through like a combination of black holes or something. Some people believe that black holes are just a portal to other universes, and our universe is, you know, basically giving birth to other universes through black holes. And maybe we're inside of what will be a white hole from another universe, which is like we were spit out with the different physical laws from a black hole from another universe. That's one theory. Yeah.
Where did your interest in all this stuff begin, do you think?
I studied it in high school a bit. Just read different books on theoretical physics. And then I majored in philosophy in college. I mainly studied Eastern philosophy, but I was probably more interested in physics, theoretical physics. And I don't know where it started. I'm really interested, I guess, in like taking questions to their logical extreme, which physics and philosophy both do. Like, you think you know something, then you should probably consider what that looks like in some extreme scenario, and then see if you still believe it, and then work backward from there to see if it's true. The idea of just questioning like your most fundamental beliefs is intriguing to me for some reason.
What else did you learn from Eastern philosophy in general?
A lot. I studied different forms of Eastern philosophy, but mainly Taoism. That was the most interesting to me. I think that the idea of, of course, yin and yang is a very common concept, and people think of yin as the opposite of yang, which I don't think is really an accurate description. It's more like they're complementary contrast, like yin sort of flows into yang and vice versa. And an example might be like a cup or a bowl or something. The yang would be the actual physical structure of it, and the yin would be the empty space that actually makes the bowl useful. You can't really have a bowl without that empty space, and those things are different but complementary. I think the idea of having things that are seemingly opposite, that are seemingly paradoxical, that are, I think that most of like the great fundamental physics truths and truths about life are fundamentally paradoxical in a way. And so there's a lot of similarities between theoretical physics and Eastern philosophy to me.
Yeah. And how has that impacted Eastern philosophy and theoretical physics? How has that impacted your fantasy sports and professional life?
Yeah, well, philosophy as a whole is about just questioning everything that you think that you know. And so I think that becoming comfortable with actually questioning things that, you know, people don't really want to be left on an island. It's uncomfortable to believe something that a lot of times if you are being sort of contrarian and believe something that other people, you know, they think you're an idiot. Most times there's a reason they think you're an idiot, and that's because you're wrong. And so you have to be comfortable being wrong like a whole lot. But the idea is that if you find something that's truly scarce, like that really scarce piece of knowledge that other people don't know, it's incredibly, incredibly valuable. So that's what's most interesting, I guess, about philosophy as a whole. In terms of Eastern philosophy, I guess what I said about the complementary contrast, I think sort of questioning the nature of time. This might seem stupid that it would help me in a business sense, but I think the idea that things are not really evolving in the way that we sort of think that they are, and that time doesn't exist in the way that we think it does, helps you. You know, maybe you get like a bad beat in when you're gambling or poker or whatever, or have something bad happen in business, or lose a negotiation, or don't get what you want anyway. That can be hard to deal with temporarily, but I think that studying Eastern philosophy, Taoism in particular, for whatever reason, helped me deal with those situations in a way that was different than the way I was before.
Time doesn't exist. What does that mean exactly?
I think if you talk to most theoretical physicists, at least a large portion of them, they don't. So time is really just mathematically the same as it's like a fourth spatial dimension. There's really no difference between time and space. And, you know, those Einstein's relativity, the faster you travel, the more time slows down. And mathematically, there is no difference between space and time, which is really, really hard for us to sort of grasp, given that we live in what we think is like a linear sort of time. But, you know, if you were to travel outside of a black hole, for example, you would experience time in the same way, but someone that were watching you fall into the black hole would like come to a pause to them. And if you turned around and watched the rest of the universe, it would speed up really, really, really fast, which is incredible. Like, we think of time as like this absolute, just linear, it ticks at the same speed, but it really doesn't. It's relative to where you are in the universe.
Have you gotten into meditation at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I started to when I started a company that I sold to another company called Churning Group, and they invested or purchased a meditation app called Headspace. And so I started to use Headspace a little bit. I still do. The main meditation I do is a little bit cynical, I guess. When I wake up, rather than like think peaceful things or try to relax my mind, every morning I think about like the worst possible things that could happen to me. Really bad things. Like, think about things with your family, whatever it is that's important to you, that those really bad things happen, and that's your new reality. And you accept that. And if you do that for a few minutes and then come back to your present reality, you become like really grateful about the way that things are. So it's like a reverse meditation that's kind of messed up in a way.
Gary Vaynerchuk does the exact same thing.
Does he?
Same thing. You didn't get it from him, did you?
No, I just talked to Gary the other night, though. He just released his NFT. I was talking to him about it.
Yeah, that's a good segue to get into the NFTs. But what is going on with NFTs? Explain NFTs to my grandmother who is listening to this podcast right now.
NFTs are just like a a representation on the internet of something that exists physically. So in the same way that, you know, if your grandmother owns a piece of art and she hangs it on her wall, she would say that that's hers, she owns it. And, you know, it's scarce because, you know, that's the only one that there is and it's hanging on her wall. And, you know, that it's completely authentic. We can prove that mathematically on the blockchain. And so it's a better version of sort of proving authenticity and ownership and scarcity on the internet. And I think it makes for a variety of different asset classes a lot better. One of which is, of course, art. One of which is collectibles, which I'm working in right now. One of which is like event tickets. Like if you imagine, you know, when you go to a game, you have to like either take a piece of paper or you have something on your phone. But if someone like copied your QR code to get into a game, then they could use that and get into the game. And, you know, and let's say that an NFL team sells tickets. They have their original sale. And then so many people, because the market is actually much larger, they resell the tickets on StubHub. And the team gets no cut of that, right? They can't track ticket sales. And the secondary market is maybe bigger than the primary market. And so NFTs allow for, you know, provable sort of ownership and scarcity. And if an NFL team had all their tickets represented as an NFT, they would be able to track those secondary sales, take a cut of those, and so on. So I think that, the general idea is that you would represent all sorts of any asset that is that exists in the real world should have some representation in the digital world.
Yeah, and you're building a platform for this in some capacity, right? With Lucky Trader HQ, how would you convert that to NFTs? Is that NFT related? Explain that to me.
So we will create our own NFT, but Lucky Trader is effectively, it's like Fantasy Labs, my first company, which was, we would model, help people backtest and model data to make them better daily fantasy sports players. And that's what we're doing at Lucky Trader is backtesting and creating models, tools, alerts, and content for people that want to buy and sell on Top Shot or race digital horses on Zed or buy CryptoPunks, that sort of thing. So it's the same sort of a concept, but just applied to NFTs.
And what do you think of Gary Vaynerchuk's V Friends? What is going on with that? Is every big influencer or media property like that going to have their own set of NFTs, do you think? That was two questions.
Eventually, I think that they will. But if you see a lot of the stuff coming out with NFTs, like we saw Gronk, Mahomes put out NFTs, they're total shit. They're worthless. These things are going to go to zero. I would say like 99% of what's out there is going to go to zero. What Gary Vee did is fundamentally different. It actually is like real utility. So you own this NFT and you have access to, you know, depending on what level you get, it represents access to see him talk or do calls with him, or, you know, you receive rev share on certain things or whatever it is. There's so many different possibilities that you just wouldn't be able to have otherwise if you buy a ticket to go watch Gary speak at an event or whatever. So I think Gary's really the first one to provide real utility with what he's doing with the NFTs. So I really like what Gary's done, and the rest of the like celebrity NFTs thus far have been not so great.
Because you need to provide some sort of real value for the person who's buying it, right?
That's right. Yep.
And so you think in some sense it's a bubble, in the sense that Gronk or someone who puts out NFTs that are meaningless are going to go to zero and they're overvalued. So you think we're in a bubble in some respect, but you also think that over the long term, over 10 years, 20 years, it's just going to be a foregone conclusion that NFTs are part of our society.
Yeah, I don't know where we are exactly in that cycle. There's some really great projects already that I think have staying power. But yeah, I think that most are pretty worthless. I don't know how it compares to like, you know, early internet days or something. People compare it to that a lot. A lot of these sites are just really bad or, you know, eventually went bust. But like in the same way that I have great confidence that Bitcoin is going to be, you know, a better version of gold and is here to stay. Like I really know that. And if it's not Bitcoin, then it would be some other crypto. I know that crypto will win. I just like fundamentally, it's very, very, very likely. I believe that in 10, 15 years, NFTs will be very, very commonplace. Even if people don't understand the underlying technology, many, if not most, assets will have some underlying NFT associated with them.
So going back to Bitcoin, your grandpa told you about it in 2011 and you didn't take it seriously. You didn't take him seriously. But when was that moment for you when it really hit that it was something to pay attention to?
Yeah. I mean, he was also like every night writing down the lottery numbers in a book, trying to like crack the code on the lottery. Yeah. Like I said, thought the moon landing was fake, all these ridiculous things. So when he told me, I mean, you know, it's just, didn't think that that was like, I didn't really look into it. In hindsight, his justification was right too. Just like, it was like, it's going to be like there's going to be massive inflation and like, yeah, whatever. So long ago. But yeah, so, yeah, sorry. What was the second part of the question?
When did you start taking it seriously?
Yeah. In 2000, I guess I looked into it really hard in starting in 2015, did not buy any. And then, like I said, gamblers were sort of exchanging value in Bitcoin and Ethereum for a while. So like a lot of us just got lucky. It's, you know, really difficult to give someone cash. And sometimes you don't want to wire money and there's fees and all these things. So if you can send Ethereum and that price is relatively stable, then that's what happened. So I had Ethereum first and then because of that, started to look into it more. And that was in, yeah, I guess, 2016. And that was when I really, really started to get involved with crypto. And then all of 2017, basically all I did most of the day was study crypto stuff.
Yeah. So why are you so confident that it's going to be the future?
I don't know. I can say like, you know, the same reason that I think NFTs are you know, a better version of collectibles. They're, you know, you have like immediate provable scarcity ownership, great liquidity, et cetera. You can transfer value really quickly, all of those things. But I just have an underlying sense that it is the future. I can't really explain exactly why. It just is something that I kind of know to be true. And there's only like been a few of those things that I've had maybe in my life where I feel great confidence about them. And this is one of them. I guess it just seems like inherently, but even if you just think of Bitcoin's upside only as gold, I'm not sure in what way Bitcoin could possibly be worse than gold. It has the finite supply. You can transfer it. It doesn't exist physically, which is the biggest benefit. You know, you can transfer across the world instantaneously with almost no fees. There's just so many reasons that's better than gold. And the idea that crypto will win just seems, even if I can't, you know, verbally explain it, it just seems so obvious to me.
What's the downside, the biggest downside for the potential of Bitcoin to go to zero or collapse?
Yeah, I don't think Bitcoin goes zero. The biggest bear case would be something like regulation banks shut off the ability to deposit on Coinbase, something like that, I think would be really bad temporarily. I still think that it eventually went out. And there's news this week that a bunch of banks are going to actually allow crypto purchases, which I think has propped the market up slightly. But yeah, I think that that would be the biggest downside scenario. Or one of them, and maybe the biggest is something that we're not even like thinking about, that is just like kind of impossible to predict, like a black swan type of event that we're not even aware of. But that would be the biggest one that I can think of.
Yeah, Balaji said something about if China stops mining, but then allows something else, and it went way over my head, and I was like, this guy's really smart and I have no idea what he's talking about, but it's probably more of a reason why he's correct. That was on the Tim Ferriss podcast. I don't know if you checked that one out.
Oh, nice. Technology. No, I didn't.
So getting back to you and switching over to the Fantasy Labs part of your life, you got Mark Cuban as an investor, which is pretty cool and makes for a great headline or a YouTube video. So how did that happen?
Yeah, that was super sick. My business partner, Peter Jennings, he was a good friend of mine. We started the company together with some engineers on the sports betting side. Peter is really good at networking. Like he's a great compliment to me because I'm not as good at that stuff. And he joined Tiger Woods celebrity poker tournament out in Vegas. It was like 100 people. You know, most of them are not really celebrities, just like there's some poker players and D-list celebrities, whatever. And they randomly seated him between Tiger and Mark Cuban.
So crazy.
It's like the luckiest person of all time. And so he sat between them. He talked to them and he was talking to Cuban a bunch about, we had just started Fantasy Labs, maybe like, I don't know, 4 months before that or something like that. Yeah, he was just telling him about it. He didn't pitch him on anything. And they just maintained communication. He was helping him with some NBA analytics and stuff. Just like, I don't know, talking to Mark, giving him value, showing him different companies and sports betting, stuff like that. And then we had the Daily Fantasy like scandal thing that happened that like almost brought down DFS. It was like, you know, where the insider trading supposedly. Peter emailed Mark and just said like, hey, do you have any advice? And Mark said, the exact email was, easy, let me invest. So then we worked with him to invest and made that announcement. And it was really good for DFS, I think. But yeah, that was how we got Mark. And I don't know if I should say this. I don't know when this is going to be out, but Mark is going to lead the round in Lucky Trader as well. So
wow,
we have him signed. I mean, we'll have that out like pretty soon.
That's awesome. And so I think the important part of that story is that Peter didn't say, hey, will you invest in my company as soon as he got seated in between them? He instead made a friendship and a connection with Mark and so that he could eventually at one point benefit down the line. Is that the important part for you as well?
Yeah, Peter is so good at that. He's so generous. I think that the companies that I want to build are always with people that are like that. They're just selfless and try to give, you know, more so than they receive, just inherently as the way that they are. Peter doesn't do that because he's like, you know, calculating EV and stuff. He's just truly like a nice, genuine, selfless person. But even if you were trying to be selfish long-term, the best decision is to be very generous and selfless short-term. You should help people. That is the best decision mathematically, I think, over long time horizons. And Peter just does that naturally so well. He just helps people. And those things always come back to help him. And, you know, I've learned a lot from him in that area, but that's something that we fundamentally believe in, which is sort of take the long view and, you know, just be helpful for to people and don't really ask for much.
Yeah, I love how you said being generous is positive EV, basically, which is a hilarious way to put it. And only a gambler or a daily fantasy sports player would say it like that.
over long time horizons, the EV of things changes such that, you know, the types of things that you fundamentally know you should do, just ethically, the type of person that you should be, is also the right thing to do long term, I think, in terms of EV.
Yeah. And as Gary Vaynerchuk would say, doing the right thing is always the right thing. So makes sense. Yeah. One thing I wanted to talk to you about was speed running. What is speed running and why did this make you so interested when a reader emailed you about speed running?
Yeah, I didn't know what speed running. So I write in a blog occasionally, just stuff that I am thinking about or whatever. And someone emailed me to check out speedrunning, which is basically videos of people trying to complete video games as fast as they can. And it's a really, really competitive area. Like if you beat a game by a half a second, that's a lot. There's so many people that are doing it, whether it's like Mario Kart or Super Mario or Wii Golf or whatever. These people are incredible. What I found interesting is like all these players are so close that the ones that end up breaking records aren't really, it's not like they're like a little bit better and they just like try to optimize how to figure out a course or whatever. You're competing with everyone in the same area. And so the ones that break records find some like really weird way to go about playing the game. Like whether it's some, like quirk in a level that they can like skip half the level, or whether it's like one of them in Wii Golf was there's one hole where it's faster to just hit it into the water repeatedly six times rather than complete the hole because there's a max strokes, I guess, per hole. But the way that they think about sort of completing the games as fast as possible, the best people are just not thinking about it in the same way as other people. And if all you did was try to copy other people and try to be a little bit better, you'd never be able to win. You have to sort of be willing to have really bad times and lose pretty much all the time in an effort to sort of wander and be curious and figure out your own way. And I found that really, really interesting. And I noticed that people in all areas that are truly elite, like the best in the world, they really don't think about, they're playing like a different game than what other people think that they are. And they're always very, very curious, just trying new things and willing to not always win all the time short term in an effort to truly be the best long term.
So how are you, what game are you playing right now?
In terms of video games, I play Mario Golf. I'm quite good at that. Like very, very good at Mario Golf. That's the only game I play. Throughout my life, usually I'm not playing any video games, but when I do, I only play one and I play it like I try to be the best. I was one of the top, NCAA football, players on Xbox when I was in high school. I was really, really good. I was number two in the world. I was actually better than number one, but it's just stayed up all day playing. In terms of video games, I've played those. Right now, I'm playing Liar's Dice a lot. So anytime I can hang out with my friends, I just take dice like a complete loser and ask them to play Liar's Dice. I think Liar's Dice is a really fun game with a lot of game theory. And depending on how you set it up, you can have a pretty big edge in Liar's Dice.
Yeah, I more so meant, what game are you playing professionally?
Oh, what do you mean?
Just in terms of, you know, you say the best in any area are playing a game separate and different from what other people think. And so it led me to think about professionally, what game are you playing that other people are confused that you're actually playing?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I am one of the best in the world in anything right now. In the past, in DFS, one of the big things was that, you know, you would think that playing fantasy sports or betting on sports is mostly like knowing sports, like you need to predict sports outcomes. That's like a part of it, of course, but you can like kind of outsource that quite easily. And, you know, for a while in tournaments where you'd have a bunch of people like sort of competing to win prizes, like, you know, you needed to get top 5% or top 2% to make a lot of money. What you predicted in terms of the sporting events was not nearly as important as what you predicted in terms of what other people are going to do. And then the correlations within your lineup. So all I did for a while was I didn't even really know anything about sports. I was really good at baseball. I didn't know anything about baseball. I just thought that was stacking properly, which is like correlations within the lineup. And then I was doing a lot of research to try to predict what other people would do based on like Vegas line or betting percentages or whatever it was. And that was way, way, way more valuable. And so most people probably did not. Now everyone knows to do that. But at that time, most people probably didn't know that that was like the real game to be playing. And yeah, now I'm focused on business and stuff. And yeah, hopefully we have an edge, but I don't think I'm one of the best in the world yet.
How did you make that transition away from daily fantasy sports? I don't know if you're still playing, but it sounds like you're more into betting on horses that are virtual and NFTs and Top Shot. So if that's true, how did you make that transition?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I still play DFS, but I mean, the edge goes away. It's the same thing that happened in poker. Like poker was really, really good for a while. And even if you were like just a pretty good player, you made a lot of money and then that goes away. And now if you want to play online poker and make money, like it's really fucking difficult.
Good luck.
Yeah. I mean, the game is just nearly solved. In DFS, there's certain spots that are good. NFL as a whole, I think is okay. But it's tough. It's people just got really, really good. If you compare, you know, 5 years ago when people were like playing John Kuhn at running back or something in one case compared to now, everyone is pretty good. There's not that many dead lineups. But in most areas of crypto, I think it's very unsolved. So there's a lot of edges probably, when it comes to crypto trading, certainly, NFTs and yeah, anything crypto related right now, everyone's sort of trying to figure it out. There's some people that are really good, way more advanced than me. But there's a lot of people that are probably like really bad right now.
Yeah. It sounds like you know which games to pick and when to play them. So how do you go about identifying when to play a game?
Yeah. Good question. I guess just having a network of friends within gambling, like you just, you know, like if there's an opportunity for something, I probably will know about it before other people do. Yeah. I think that how new a game is, the amount of randomness that's involved in it is really important because you want a game that's actually pretty random. You can't have like, you know, chess is a great game. It's an amazing game to play. It'll sharpen your mind, but no one's gambling on chess because the top player wins like all the time. You know, like you're never going to have someone who's even slightly worse beat a grandmaster. They just never win. But in poker, you can, like, I could play Tom Dwan or whatever. And even over like 100 hands, I might be able to beat him or something. Right. Even though I stink at poker and he's amazing. So having that randomness in a game, I think is really important. And then you should always be asking yourself, I think, like, what reason do I have to believe that? I think this is really important, actually, that most people, they don't do this. What real reason do I have to believe that the person on the opposite side or the people on the opposite side of what I'm doing are dumber than I am? And you should have a really good reason for that. And most people don't, whether they're trading crypto or stocks or playing poker. Like you should have a really good reason that you're getting it in good and they're not. And if you're not, then you're probably the person losing money.
How did you come to that conclusion with NBA Top Shot?
So Top Shot, I thought was at that time, I had actually just written an article maybe a month before. I didn't even know about Top Shot, or I had heard about it a few times, but never really looked into it. And I had just written an article about how to find the next big thing. And the things that I wrote about were, the main thing was find something that exists physically that people love. Where is like the intersection of where that, how is that going to turn into, you know, some digital phenomenon or whatever? Like what could be better digitally than it is physically? And then another thing was look at what young people are interested in. And Top Shot to me, I had tried for a few months to get into trading cards, and I bought some cards, and it's a horrible process to if you want to buy baseball cards, you can like buy boxes online. Maybe you can get them in stores, but they're sold out. So you buy it, it's shipped to you, you open packs if you want. And then maybe you get a good card. Then you have to send the card into a grading service, like mail it, and then hope nothing happens to it. And then they grade it. And maybe it's worse than what you thought it was, but maybe it's better, whatever. Then they send it back to you. You hope again that you get the card back. This takes months and months. And then you have to put it on eBay. And then you have to sell it, and then hope the person doesn't like reverse the transaction, which they do a lot because maybe the, you know, if the player gets hurt or whatever it is. It's a horrible, horrible process compared to Top Shot. You know, you buy it, it's yours. You can immediately put it back on the market. And so if you have an edge, you can just repeat that edge repeatedly. So it was just like sort of everything clicked. All the things I was interested in, I was interested in trading cards, but didn't like the process. I love sports. I love gambling. I love crypto. And, you know, even though it's not obvious that Top Shot runs on top of a blockchain, on top of Flow, they do. They've done a good job of sort of hiding it. But, you know, it's crypto, alternative assets. Everything was just like, you know, all these things that I was looking for in one. And so, that was the reason that I sort of went all in at that time on Top Shot.
You mentioned that it's important to look for what kids are doing. And why is that so important?
I don't know. It just seems like, that's generally the right side to be on. I guess practically like kids, smart kids are generally don't have money, but they're going to have money. And so the things that they're interested in are the things that people are going to spend money on in the future. But certainly with anything related to technology, I've never really seen us trend toward the direction of what old people are doing.
That's a great point. So it's when Warren Buffett says no Bitcoin, that's a dumb thing, you're like, okay, you're okay, boomer, basically.
Well, Warren Buffett is much, much smarter than I am, but there's other smart people, of course, that are into crypto. And crypto is a great example where the overall age of people that are like really think Bitcoin is a great store of value compared to gold is, you know, it's much younger. Not to say that that's right, but it's definitely right. And technology related, it seems that younger people are pretty much always on the right side of that.
So where's the next big opportunity?
I think probably people, anything in, there's going to be a really big opportunity in NFTs. It might not be in the way that people think. Like right now, most of the stuff is people associate NFTs with digital art and stuff like that, which I'm very interested in, but I never thought it was necessarily a great investment per se. But I think figuring out the ways that NFTs will sort of change real world things that we do, whether it's you know, event tickets, you know, insurance, real estate, you know, proving ownership of actual physical real estate, those sorts of things. And then in the digital world, I think maybe we're a bit away, but probably a really good investment is in digital land, sort of the metaverse concept. I do believe in, I don't know how long it'll take, 15, 20 years, whatever. We're going to have a huge amount of the, you know, the way that we interact in the physical world will be online, and the people that are best set up for that, whether it's to owning top real estate in the metaverse, or, you know, having some of the top sort of art, or the way that you're, you know, if you have a CryptoPunk and you have a 3D sort of representation of that in the metaverse, I think that these things will be generally good investments. Seems a bit far out from now, but yeah, all of the ways that we do business or live our lives right now in the physical world that could be digital, even theoretically, I think that they will be digital, and that's a good place to look.
I'm in the middle of Snow Crash right now, and that talks a lot about the metaverse. I don't know if you're familiar with the book.
I'm not.
Yeah, it's a really interesting read from 1992 that talks about what the world is going to look like, and it's very it all seems like it's all possible, all the things that he talks about in this fiction book. So
yeah, Snow Crash.
Yeah, by Neal Stephenson, I believe.
Yep, I'll get it now.
He's quick with it. Jonathan, anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap up the conversation?
No, not really, man. I really, you're a great interviewer. I watched some of your others. You ask unique questions, and I really appreciate what you're doing and just crushing it on your own. And, you know, it seems like just offering people a lot of value, and really respect what you're doing. So, I appreciate you having me on, but just have a lot of respect for you, doing this podcast, and you as an interviewer.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. Where can people find more from you if they want to check out more Jonathan Bales?
I'm Bales Football on Twitter. You could go there.
Bales Football on Twitter. That'll be in the show notes. Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate you. And I'll see you soon in the metaverse.
Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
That was my episode with Jonathan Bales. If you enjoyed this episode or have any thoughts or feedback about it, let me know on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda. Also, just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening until this moment right now. It means the world to me. And lastly, you should also, if you made it this far, subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Danny Miranda. Like I said, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.